important to Larch. How he wished he had kissed Homer more, when he'd had the chance. He went from bed to bed, kissing the boys. It occurred to him he didn't know all their names, but he kissed them anyway. He kissed all of them. When he left the room, Smoky Fields asked the darkness, "What was that all about?" But no one else was awake, or else no one wanted to answer him. "I wish he would kiss me," thought Nurse Edna, who had a very alert ear for unusual goings-on. "I think it's nice," Mrs. Grogan said to Nurse Angela, when Nurse Angela told her about it. "I think it's senile," Nurse Angela said. But Homer Wells, at Wally's window, did not know that Dr. Larch's kisses were out in the world in search of him. He didn't know, either, he could never have imagined it, that Candy was also awake, and also worried. "If he does stay, if he doesn't go back to St. Cloud's," she was thinking, "what will I do?" The sea tugged all around her. Both the darkness and the moon were failing. There came that time when Homer Wells could make out the boundaries of the cider house, but the roof did not wink to him, no matter how he moved his head. With no signal flashing to him, Homer may have thought he was speaking to the dead when he whispered, "Good night, Fuzzy." He did not know that Fuzzy Stone, like Melanie, was looking for him. Chapter 7. Before the War. One day that August, a hazy sun hung over the coastal road between York Harbor and Agunquit. It was not the staring sun of Marseille, and not the cool, crisp sun that blinks on much of the coast of Maine at that time of year. It was a St. Cloud's sunlight, steamy and flat, and Melanie was irritated by it and sweating when she accepted a ride in a milk truck that was heading inland. She knew she was south of Portland, and that there was relatively little of the Maine coast that lay south of Portland, yet it had taken her these months to search the apple orchards in this limited vicinity. She was not discouraged. She knew she'd had some bad luck, and that her luck was due to improve. She'd managed to pick the pockets of several citizens of Portland. This tided her over for a while. She'd gotten in trouble with some Navy men whose pockets she'd tried to pick in Kittery. She'd managed not to have sex with the men, but they had broken her nose, which had healed crookedly, and they had chipped her two front teeth, the big uppers. Not that she tended to smile a lot anyway, but she had since adopted a rather close-mouthed and tight-lipped expression. The first two orchards she'd visited were within view of the ocean, but they were not called Ocean View, and no one in either orchard had heard of the Ocean View orchards. She then found an inland orchard where someone told her he had heard of an Ocean View, but that he was sure it was just a name, that the place wasn't anywhere near the coast. She took a job washing bottles in a dairy in Biddeford, but she quit it as soon as she'd made some traveling money. The orchard between York Harbor and Agunquit turned out to be called York Farm, which looked as plain as its name, but Melanie told the milk truck driver to let her out there anyway. It was at least an apple orchard. Someone might have heard of Ocean View. The foreman at York Farm took one look at Melanie and assumed she was a would-be picker, trying to get work ahead of the migrants. "You're about 3 weeks early," he told her. "We're only picking the Gravensteins this month, and I don't need help picking them. They ain't that many." "You heard of an orchard called Ocean View?" Melanie asked the foreman. "You used to pick there?" the foreman asked. "No, I'm just looking for it," Melanie said. "It sounds like a rest home," the foreman said. But when Melanie didn't even smile, he stopped being friendly. "You any idea how many places there must be in Maine called Ocean View?" he asked. Melanie shrugged. If they were hiring at York Farm in 3 weeks, she thought she wouldn't mind staying. Some of the other pickers might have heard of the place where Homer Wells had gone. "You got anything for me to do?" Melanie asked the foreman. "In 3 weeks, if you know how to pick," he added. "There can't be much to picking apples," Melanie said. "You think it's easy?" the foreman asked. "Come here," he said, and walked her through the dingy apple mart. Two older women were hand-lettering a wooden price list. In the first orchard behind the apple mart, the foreman proceeded to lecture Melanie on the art of apple picking. "You take an apple with its stem," the foreman said, "but just above the stem is the bud for next year's apple. That's the spur," he said. "You pull the spur, you pull 2 years in one." He demonstrated to Melanie how to twist the apple. "Twist, don't pull," he told her. Melanie reached into the tree and twisted an apple free. She did it correctly. She looked at the foreman and shrugged. She took a bite of the apple, which wasn't ripe. She spit out the bite and threw the apple away. "That's a northern spy," the foreman explained. "We picked them last. They're not ready before October." Melanie was bored. She started back toward the apple mart. "I'll give you 10 cents a bushel," the foreman called after her. "Only a nickel a bushel for drops, or if you bruise the fruit. You look pretty strong," he said, following after her. "If you get the hang of it, you might pick 90 bushels a day. I've had guys here doing 100 bushels. That's 10 bucks a day," he said. "Come back in 3 weeks," he added, stopping next to the women working on the sign in the apple mart. Melanie was already back on the road. "I'll be somewhere else in 3 weeks," she said to the foreman. "Too bad," the foreman said. He watched her walk down the road, headed back toward the coast. "She looks strong," he said to one of the women in the mart. "I'll bet she weighs about 160. "She's just a tramp," the woman said. About a mile away from the apple mart, Melanie walked by an orchard where 2 workers were picking gravensteins. One of the men waved to her. Melanie started to wave back, but thought better of it. She was not more than 100 yards past the men when she heard their pickup truck coming after her. The truck pulled up next to her, off to the side of the road, and the driver said to her, "You look like you lost your sweetheart. Good thing you found me." The man in the passenger side of the truck opened the door before the truck stopped rolling. "You better leave me alone, Buster," Melanie said to the driver. But the other man was already around the truck and coming closer. Melanie hopped over the road ditch and ran into the orchard. The man pursued her, whooping. The driver killed the truck motor and joined the chase. He left his door open. He was in such a hurry. There was nowhere to hide, but the orchards seemed endless. Melanie ran down one row between the trees, then up another. The first man to chase her was gaining on her, but she noticed that the driver lagged farther and farther behind. He was a big, slow man, and he was huffing and puffing after he'd passed 5 or 6 trees. Melanie was huffing and puffing herself, but she ran with a certain even strength, and although the first smaller man was gaining on her, she could hear him breathing harder and harder. She crossed a dirt road into another orchard. Way behind her, maybe 200 or 300 yards, she saw that the heavy driver had slowed to a determined walk. "Get her, Charlie," he called to the faster man. To Charlie's surprise, Melanie stopped and turned to face him. She caught her breath fairly quickly, then she ran at Charlie. She moved low to the ground, a kind of animal whine in her throat, and the man called Charlie did not have time to stop and catch his breath before she flung herself upon him. They fell together. When she felt her knee against his throat, she jounced on him. He made a choking sound and rolled on his side. Melanie jumped up to her feet. She stamped twice on his face, and when Charlie managed to turn over, on all fours, she jumped up as high as she could and landed with both feet in the small of his back. He was already unconscious when she pinned his arms behind him and bit his ear. She felt her teeth meet. She let him go and knelt beside him. She caught her breath again. Then she spit on him. When she stood up, she saw that the heavy man had managed only to cross the dirt road into the second orchard. "Charlie, get up," he said, wheezing, but Charlie didn't move. Melanie rolled Charlie over on his back and undid his belt. She tugged it roughly through the loops until she had the belt off him. The big man, the driver, was now only 3 or 4 apple trees away from her. She wound one end of the belt twice around her wrist and fist. When she let her arm hang at her side, the buckle end of the belt touched the top of her foot. The big man stopped only 2 trees away from her. "What'd you do to Charlie?" he asked her. But Melanie started swinging the belt. She swung it around and around her head, faster and faster. The square brass belt buckle began to whistle. Melanie advanced on the heavy driver, a man in his late 40s or early 50s. His hair was gray and thin, and he had quite a paunch thrust ahead of himself. He stood his ground for a moment and watched Melanie come nearer to him. The belt was a broad strap of sweat and oil-stained leather. The brass buckle was the size of a man's palm. With its square edges, it hummed through the air like the north wind. It made a sound like a scythe.
"Hey," said the fat man.
"Hey what, Buster?" Melanie said. She suddenly lowered the belt and cracked the buckle across one of the man's shins, where it lifted up a flap of blue jeans and skin that looked like a torn dollar bill. When the man bent over to grab his legs, she swiped the belt buckle across the side of his face. He sat down suddenly and put his hand to his cheek, where he discovered a gouge the approximate length and thickness of a cigarette. He hadn't the time to contemplate this wound before the belt buckle smacked him squarely across the bridge of his nose, the force of the blow and his pain temporarily blinding him. He tried to cover his head with one arm while he groped for Melanie with the other, but she found it easy to hit him everywhere, and he quickly drew up his knees to his chest and covered his face and head with both arms. The buckle raked and nicked his spine for a while. Then she stopped using the buckle end on him. She just strapped him with the flat end of the belt across the backs of his legs and his ass. It seemed she would never stop. "Are the keys in that truck, Buster?" she asked in between blows.
"Yes,"
he cried, but she hit him some more before she left him. She took the belt with her, walking back through the first orchard, occasionally taking a swipe at an apple with the tip of the belt, with which she had developed some skill. The man called Charlie regained consciousness, but he didn't move or open his eyes.
"Is she gone, Charlie?"
the fat man asked after a while, because he hadn't moved or opened his eyes either.
"I hope so,"
Charlie said, but neither of the men moved until they heard Melanie start the truck. It crossed her mind that she was in debt to Dr. Larch for once getting her a job where she had learned to drive, but it was a passing thought. She turned the truck around and drove back to the Apple Mart, where the foreman was surprised to see her. She told the foreman, in front of the women who were working on the sign, that two of his men had tried to rape her. One of the men, the fat one, was married to the woman who was hand-lettering the sign. Melanie said to the foreman that he could fire those two men and give her their jobs. "I can do whatever the two of them can do, and better than they do it," Melanie said. Or else, she said to the foreman, he could call the police and she'd tell the police how she'd been attacked. The woman whose husband had assaulted Melanie was pale and silent, but the other woman said to the foreman what she'd said earlier.
"She's just a tramp. What do you want to listen to her for?"
"I can do everything you do, too," Melanie said to the woman, "especially everything you do on your back. You look like you're shit on your back," Melanie said,
and she flicked the flat end of the belt toward the woman, who jumped away as if the belt were a snake.
"Hey, that's Charlie's belt," the foreman said.
"Right," said Melanie. This echo of Homer Wells nearly brought tears to her eyes.
"Charlie lost it," she added.
She went to the truck and took out her bundle, her few things, which were all wrapped in Mrs. Grogan's coat. She used the belt to cinch the coat and its contents more securely together.
"I can't fire those guys," the foreman told her. "They've worked here all their lives."
"So call the police, then," Melanie said.
"She's threatening you,"
the fat man's wife said to the foreman.
"No shit," Melanie said.
The foreman got Melanie settled comfortably in the cider house.
"You can stay here at least until the picking crew comes," he said. "I don't know if you want to stay here when they're here. Sometimes there's women with them, and sometimes there's kids. But if it's just men, I don't think you want to stay here, the Negroes."
"It'll do for now, anyway," Melanie said, looking around. There were fewer beds than there were in the Worthingtons' cider house, and it was a lot less neat and clean. York Farm was a much smaller, poorer orchard than Ocean View, and there was no one there who cared very much about the style and shape of the quarters for the migrants. York Farm was without an Olive Worthington. The vinegar smell was stronger in the York Farm cider house, and behind the press were dried clots of pumice that clung to the wall like apple scab. There was no stove in the kitchen section, just a hot plate which tended to blow the old fuses. There was one fuse box for the pump and grinder and the low-watt overhead bulbs. The light in the refrigerator was out, but this at least made the mold less visible. It was fine for Melanie, who had contributed lastingly to the history of the many wrecked rooms in both the abandoned and the lived-in buildings of St. Cloud's.
"This Ocean View, the one you're looking for?" the foreman asked. "How come you're looking for it?"
"I'm looking for my boyfriend," Melanie told him.
"She has a boyfriend?" the foreman wondered.
He went to see how the men were doing. The fat man, whose wife had accompanied him to the hospital, although she had not spoken to him and wouldn't for more than 3 months, sat rather placidly through his stitches, but he grew quite excited when the foreman told him that he'd fixed Melanie up in the cider house and had given her a job, at least through the harvest.
"You gave her a job?"
the fat man cried.
"She's a killer!"
"Then you'd better keep the fuck out of her way," the foreman told him. "If you get in her way, I'll have to fire you. She damn near made me already."
The fat man had a broken nose and needed a total of 41 stitches, 37 in his face and 4 on his tongue, where he'd bitten himself. The man called Charlie was better off in the stitches department.
He required only 4 to close the wound in his ear. But Melanie had cracked 2 of his ribs by jumping on him. He had received a concussion from having his head stamped on. His lower back would suffer such repeated muscle spasms that he would be kept off a ladder through the harvest.
"Holy cow," Charlie said to the foreman. "I'd hate to meet the son of a bitch who's her boyfriend."
"Just keep out of her way," the foreman advised him.
"Has she still got my belt?" Charlie asked the foreman. "If you ask her for your belt back, I'll have to fire you. Get yourself a new belt," the foreman said.
"You won't see me asking her for nothing," Charlie said. "She didn't say her boyfriend was coming here, did she?" he asked the foreman. But the foreman said that if Melanie was looking for her boyfriend, the boyfriend must not have given her any directions. He must have left her.
"And God help him if he left her," the foreman said,
over and over again. "Well," said the woman in the apple mart who had called Melanie a tramp,
"if you had a woman like that, wouldn't you try to leave her?"
"In the first place," the foreman said, "I would never have a woman like that. And in the second place, if I did have her, I'd never leave her. I wouldn't dare." In the cider house at York Farm, somewhere inland from York Harbor, somewhere west of Ogunquit, with several hundred miles of coastline between her and Homer Wells, Melanie lay listening to the mice. Sometimes they scurried, sometimes they gnawed. The first mouse, bold enough to race across the foot of her mattress, was swatted so hard with the buckle end of Charlie's belt that it flew across 4 beds all in a row and struck the wall with a soft thud. Melanie promptly retrieved it. It was quite dead, its back broken. With the aid of a pencil without a point, Melanie was able to prop the dead mouse into a sitting position on her night table, an inverted apple crate, which she then moved to the foot of her bed. It was her belief that the dead mouse might function as a kind of totem to warn other mice away, and, indeed, no mouse bothered Melanie for several hours. She lay in the weak light reading Jane Eyre, the empty, dark orchard ripening all around her. She reread twice that passage near the end of chapter 27 that concludes, "Preconceived opinions, foregone determinations, are all I have at this hour to stand by. There I plant my foot." With that she closed the book and turned out the light. Melanie lay bravely on her back, her broad nostrils full of the sharp cider vinegar air. The same air Homer Wells is smelling, she thought. Just before she fell asleep, she whispered, although there were only the mice to hear her, "Good night, sunshine." The next day it rained. It rained from Kennebunkport to Christmas Cove. There was such a strong northeast wind that the flags and the boats moored at the Haven Club, even though they were saturated with rain, pointed to shore and made a brisk snapping sound as constant as the chafe of Ray Kendall's lobster boat against the old worn rubber tires that padded his dock. Ray would spend the day under the John Deere in building number 2. He was alternately replacing the tractor's manifold and sleeping. It was the place he slept best, under a large, familiar machine. He was never detected. His legs at times extended from under the vehicle in a posture of such extreme sprawl that he looked dead, run over, or crushed. One of the apple workers, startled to see him, would speak out, "Ray, is that you?" Whereupon, like Dr. Larch brought back from ether, Ray Kendall would wake up and say, "Right here. I'm right here." "Some job, huh?" the worried party would inquire. "Yep," Ray would say. "Some job, all right." The rain came pelting down, the wind so strongly on shore that the gulls moved inland. At York Farm, they huddled against the cider house and woke up Melanie with their fretting. At Ocean View, they squatted together on the tin roof of the cider house, where a crew of scrubbers and painters were at work again. Grace Lynch, as usual, had the worst job, scouring the 1,000-gallon cider tank. She was kneeling inside the vat, and the sound of her movements in there impressed the others with a kind of furtive energy, as if an animal were scrounging for a nest or for its dinner. Meanie Hyde had left the cider house on what his wife, Florence, called another bullshit errand. Meanie had determined that the fan belt on the conveyor was loose, and so he removed it and said he was taking it to Ray Kendall to see what Ray could do about it. "So what's Ray going to do with a loose fan belt?" Florence asked Meanie. "Order a new one, or take a piece out of that one, right?" "I suppose," Meanie said warily. "And what do you need the conveyor for today?" Florence asked.
"I'm just taking it to Ray," Meany said peevishly.
"You don't want to work too much, do you?" Florence said, and Meany shuffled out into the rain. He smiled and winked at Homer Wells as he was climbing into the pickup.
"I got a lazy husband," Florence said happily.
"That's better than some other kinds," said Irene Titcomb, and everyone automatically looked in the direction of the 1,000-gallon vat where Grace Lynch was feverishly scrubbing. Irene and Florence, who had patient, steady hands, were painting the sashes and the window trim in the bedroom wing of the cider house. Homer Wells and Big Dot Taft and Big Dot's kid sister, Deborah Pettigrew, were painting the kitchen with broader, more carefree strokes.
"I hope you don't feel I'm cramping you," Big Dot said to Deborah and Homer. "I ain't your chaperone or nothing. If you want to make out, just go right ahead."
Deborah Pettigrew looked embarrassed and cross, and Homer smiled shyly. It was funny, he thought, how you have two or three dates with someone, and just kiss them and touch them in a few odd places, and everyone starts talking to you as if you've got doing it on your mind every minute. Homer's mind was much more on Grace Lynch in the vat than it was on Deborah Pettigrew, who stood right beside him painting the same wall. When Homer encountered the light switch by the kitchen door, he asked Big Dot Taft if he should just paint all around it, or let Florence and Irene, with their smaller brushes, trim it more neatly.
"Just paint right over it," said Big Dot Taft. "We do this every year. We just make it look new and fresh. We're not trying to win no neatness contest."
By the light switch, there was a tack that pinned a piece of typing paper to the wall. The type itself was very faint, from long exposure to the sunlight that came through the kitchen's curtainless windows. It was some kind of list. The bottom quarter of the page had been torn away. Whatever it was incomplete. Homer pulled the tack out of the wall and would have crumpled the paper and tossed it toward the trash barrel if the top line of type hadn't caught his attention. "Cider House Rules," the top line said. What rules, he wondered, reading down the page. The rules were numbered. 1. Please don't operate the grinder or the press if you've been drinking. 2. Please don't smoke in bed or use candles. 3. Please don't go up on the roof if you've been drinking, especially at night. 4. Please wash out the press cloths the same day or night they are used. 5. Please remove the rotary screen immediately after you've finished pressing and hose it clean when the pumice is still wet on it. 6. Please don't take bottles with you when you go up on the roof. 7. Please, even if you are very hot or if you've been drinking, don't go into the cold storage room to sleep. 8. Please give your shopping list to the crew boss by 7 o'clock in the morning. 9. There should be no more than half a dozen people on the roof at any one time. If there were a few more rules, Homer couldn't read them because the page had been ripped off. Homer handed the torn paper to Big Dot Taft.
"What's all this about the roof?" he asked Deborah Pettigrew.
"You can see the ocean from the roof," Deborah said.
"That ain't it," said Big Dot Taft. "At night you can see the Ferris wheel and the carnival lights in Cape Kenneth."
"Big deal," said Homer Wells.
"It's no big deal to me either," Big Dot Taft said, "but those darkies really like it."
"They sit up on the roof all night some nights," Deborah Pettigrew said.
"They get drunk up there and fall off some nights," Florence Hyde announced from the bedroom wing. "They break bottles up there and cut themselves all up," said Irene Titcomb.
"Well, not every night they don't," said Big Dot Taft. "And one night one of them got so drunk and sweaty, running the press, that he passed out in the cold storage and woke up with pneumonia," Deborah Pettigrew said.
"You don't exactly wake up with pneumonia," said Homer Wells. "It's more complicated than that."
"Excuse me," Deborah said sulkily.
"Anyway, nobody pays no attention to them rules," Big Dot Taft said. "Every year Olive writes them up, and every year nobody pays no attention."
"All the picking crews we've ever had are just children," said Florence Hyde. "If Olive didn't go shopping for them every day, they'd starve."
"They never get themselves organized," Irene Titcomb said.
"One of them got his whole arm caught in the grinder," Big Dot Taft recalled. "Not just his fool hand, his whole arm."
"Yuck," said Deborah Pettigrew.
"Yuck is what his arm was, all right," said Florence Hyde.
"How many stitches?" asked Homer Wells.
"You're really curious, you know that?" Deborah Pettigrew asked him.
Well, they don't do no harm except to themselves, said Irene Titcomb philosophically. What's it matter if they want to drink too much and roll off the roof? Wasn't nobody ever killed here, was there? Not yet, said Grace Lynch's tight, thin voice, her words strangely amplified because she was speaking from the bottom of the 1,000-gallon vat. The combination of the strangeness of her voice and the rareness of her making a contribution of any kind to their conversation made them all silent. Everyone was just working away when Wally drove up in the green van with Louise Toby. He dropped Louise off with her own bucket and brush and asked the rest of them if they needed anything. More brushes? More paint? Just give me a kiss, honey, said Florence Hyde. Just take us to the movies, said Big Dot Taft. Just propose to me, just propose, cried Irene Titcomb. Everyone was laughing when Wally left. It was almost lunchtime, and everyone knew that Squeeze Louise had come to work particularly late. She usually arrived with Herb Fowler, more or less on time. Louise looked especially pouty this morning, and no one spoke to her for a while. "Well, you can be having your period or something and still say good morning," said Big Dot Taft after a while. "Good morning," said Louise Toby. "La-dee-da," said Irene Titcomb. Deborah Pettigrew bumped Homer in the side. When he looked at her, she winked. Nothing else happened until Herb Fowler drove by and offered to take everyone to the Drinkwater Road diner for lunch. Homer looked at the vat, but Grace Lynch made no appearance over its rim. She just continued her scratching and hissing noises in the vat's bottom. She wouldn't have accepted the invitation anyway. Homer was thinking he probably should accept it to get away from Grace Lynch, but he had promised himself to investigate the roof of the cider house. He wanted to find the spot that had glinted to him so mysteriously in the moonlight. And now that he'd heard about the cider house rules, and that you could see the ocean, and the Cape Kenneth Ferris wheel from the roof, he wanted to climb up there, even in the rain. He went outside with all the others, thinking that Grace Lynch might assume he'd gone with them, and then he told Herb Fowler out in the driveway that he was going to stay. He felt a finger hook him in his blue jeans pocket, one of the front ones, and when Herb and the others had gone, he looked in his pocket and discovered the rubber. The prophylactic's presence in his pocket urged him up on the cider house roof in a hurry. His appearance there surprised the gulls, whose sudden and raucous flight surprised him. He had not noticed them huddled on the slope of the roof that faced away from him, and away from the wind. The roof was slippery in the rain. He had to grip the corrugated grooves with both hands and place his feet very close to each other as he climbed. The pitch of the roof was not too steep, or he wouldn't have been able to climb it at all. To his surprise, he found a number of planks, old 2x4s, nailed to the seaward side of the roof's apex. Benches, he thought. Even at an angle, they were at least more comfortable to sit on than the tin. He sat there in the rain and tried to imagine the pleasure of the view, but the weather was much too stormy for him to be able to see the farthest orchards. The ocean was completely obscured, and he had to imagine where, on a clear night, the Ferris wheel and the carnival lights in Cape Kenneth would be. He was getting soaked and was about to climb down when he saw the knife. It was a big switchblade, the blade end stuck into the 2x4 at the top of the roof alongside him. The handle, which was fake horn, was cracked in two places, and when Homer Wells tried to extract the blade from the wood, the handle broke in two in his hands. That was why it had been left there, apparently. With the handle broken, the knife wouldn't close properly. It wasn't safe to carry that way, and besides, the blade was rusted. The whole roof was rusted, Homer noticed. There was no single spot shiny enough to have reflected the moonlight back to Wally's window. Then he noticed the broken glass. Some larger pieces were caught in the corrugated grooves in the tin. It must have been one of those pieces of glass that caught the moon, Homer thought. Beer bottle glass and rum bottle glass, whiskey bottle glass and gin bottle glass, he supposed. He tried to imagine the black men drinking at night on the roof. But the rain had soaked him through, and the wind now thoroughly chilled him. Inching his way back down the roof, to the edge where the ground was the safest jump, he cut his hand, just a small cut, on a piece of glass he didn't see. By the time he went back inside the cider house, the cut was bleeding freely. Quite a lot of blood for such a small cut, he thought, and he wondered if perhaps there was a tiny piece of glass still inside the cut. Grace Lynch must have heard him rinsing the wound in the kitchen sink, if she hadn't heard him on the roof. To Homer's surprise, Grace was still in the 1,000-gallon vat.
Help me, she called to him. I can't get out.
It was a lie. She was just trying to draw him to the edge of the tank. But orphans have a gullible nature. Orphanage life is plain. By comparison, every lie is sophisticated. Homer Wells, although he approached the rim of the cider vat with trepidation, approached steadily. The quickness of her thin hands and the wiry strength with which they gripped his wrists surprised him. He nearly lost his balance. He was almost pulled into the tank on top of her. Grace Lynch had taken all her clothes off, but the extreme definition of her bones struck Homer more powerfully than anything forbidden in her nakedness. She looked like a starved animal contained in a more or less humane trap. Humane, except that it was evident from her bruises that her captor beat her regularly and hard. The bruises on her hips and thighs were the largest. The thumbprint bruises on the backs of her arms were the deepest purple hue, and there was a yellow to green bruise on one of her small breasts that looked especially angry. "Let me go," said Homer Wells.
"I know what they do where you come from," Grace Lynch cried,
tugging on his wrists. "Right," said Homer Wells. Systematically, he began to peel back her fingers, but she scrambled nimbly up the side of the vat and bit him sharply on the back of his hand. He had to push her, then, and he might have hurt her if they both hadn't heard the splashy arrival of Wally in the green van. Grace Lynch let Homer go and scurried to put on her clothes. Wally sat in the van in the drenching rain and pumped the horn. Homer ran outside to see what he wanted.
"Get in," Wally shouted. "We've got to go rescue my stupid father. He's in some kind of trouble at Sanborn's."
For Homer Wells, who'd grown up in a world without fathers, it was a shock to hear that anyone who had a father would call his father stupid, even if it was true. There was a peck bag of Gravensteins in the passenger seat of the van. Homer held the apples in his lap as Wally drove down Drinkwater Road to Sanborn's general store. The proprietors, Mildred and Bert Sanborn, were among Senior's oldest friends. He'd been a schoolboy with both of them and had once dated Millie, before he'd met Olive and before Millie had married Bert. Titus Hardware and Plumbing was next door to Sanborn's. Warren Titus, the plumber, was standing on the porch of the general store, not letting anyone inside, when Wally and Homer drove into Hart's Rock.
"It's a good thing you're here, Wally," Warren said when the boys ran up to the porch. "Your dad's got some wild hair across his ass."
In the store, Homer and Wally saw that Mildred and Bert Sanborn had, for the moment, cornered Senior in a niche of shelves reserved for baking goods. Senior appeared to have littered the floor, and much of himself, with all the flour and sugar within his reach. His trapped appearance reminded Homer of Grace Lynch.
"What's the trouble, Pop?" Wally asked his father.
Mildred Sanborn gave a sigh of relief to see Wally, but Bert wouldn't take his eyes off Senior.
"Trouble, Pop," Senior said. "He got in a rage when he couldn't find the dog food," Bert said to Wally, without looking away from Senior.
Bert thoroughly expected Senior to bolt at any moment to another part of the store and destroy it.
"What do you want with dog food, Pop?" Wally asked his father.
"Dog food, Pop," Senior repeated.
"It's like he don't remember, Wally," Bert Sanborn said. "We told him he didn't have a dog," Mildred said.
"I remember doing it to you, Millie," Senior shouted.
"There he goes again," Bert said.
"Senior, Senior," he said gently. "We're all your friends here." "I have to feed Blinky," Senior said.
"Blinky was his dog when he was a boy," Millie Sanborn told Wally.
"If Blinky was still alive, Senior," Bert Sanborn said, "he'd be older than we are." "Older than we are," Senior said.
"Let's go home, Pop," Wally said.
"Home, Pop," Senior said.
But he let Wally and Homer lead him to the van.
"I tell you, Wally, it's not booze," said Warren Titus,
who opened the side door of the van for them.
"It's not on his breath, not this time."
"It's something else, Wally,"
Bert Sanborn said.
"Who are you?"
Senior asked Homer.
"I'm Homer Wells, Mr. Worthington," Homer said.
"Mr. Worthington," Senior said.
When they'd driven for almost 5 minutes in silence, Senior shouted,
"Everyone just shut up!"
When they got to Ocean View, Olive met the van in the driveway. She ignored Senior and spoke to Wally.
"I don't know what he's had this morning unless it's vodka. It wasn't on his breath when he left.
I wouldn't have let him take the van if I thought he'd been drinking. I think it's something else, Mom, Wally said. With Homer's help, he led Senior to the bedroom, got his shoes off, and coaxed him to lie down on the bed.
You know, I drilled Millie once, Senior told his son.
Sure you did, Pop, said Wally.
I drilled Millie! I drilled Millie! Senior said.
Wally tried to humor Senior with a limerick. Senior had taught Wally a lot of limericks, but Senior had difficulty remembering a limerick now, even if Wally talked him through it line by line.
Remember the Duchess of Kent, Pop? Wally asked his father.
Sure,
Senior said, but he didn't say anything more.
Oh, pity the Duchess of Kent, Wally began.
But Senior just listened.
Her cunt is so dreadfully bent, Wally said.
Bent?
Senior said. Wally tried again, two lines at a time.
Oh, pity the Duchess of Kent. Her cunt is so dreadfully bent.
Dreadfully bent,
Senior sang out.
Oh, pity the Duchess of Kent.
Her cunt is so dreadfully bent. The poor wench doth stammer, I need a sledgehammer to pound a man into my vent. My God, thought Homer Wells. But Senior appeared to be baffled. He said nothing. Wally and Homer left him when they thought he'd fallen asleep. Downstairs, Homer Wells told Olive and Wally that he thought it was something neurological.
Neurological, Olive said.
What's that mean? Wally said. They heard Senior cry out from upstairs.
Vent!
He shouted. Homer Wells, who had a habit of repeating the pigtails of sentences, knew that Senior's repetitions were insane. That habit was the first symptom he described in his letter about Senior Worthington to Dr. Larch. He repeats everything, he wrote to Dr. Larch. Homer also noted that Senior appeared to forget the names of the most common things. He recalled how the man had become stuck asking Wally for a cigarette. He just kept pointing at Wally's breast pocket. I think the word for cigarette had escaped him, wrote Homer Wells. Homer had also observed that Senior could not operate the latch on the glove compartment the last time that Homer had driven him to Sanborn's for some simple shopping. And the man had the oddest habit of picking at his clothes all the time. It's as if he thinks he's got dirt or hair or lint on his clothes, wrote Homer Wells. But there's nothing there. Olive Worthington assured Homer that the family doctor, a geezer even older than Dr. Larch, was quite certain that Senior's problems were entirely alcohol-related.
Doc Perkins is too old to be a doctor anymore, Mom, Wally said.
Doc Perkins delivered you. I guess he knows what he's doing, Olive said.
I'll bet I was easy to deliver, Wally said cheerfully.
I bet you were, imagined Homer Wells, who thought that Wally took everything in the world for granted. Not in a selfish or spoiled way, but like a prince of Maine, like a king of New England. Wally was just born to be in charge.
Dr. Larch's letter to Homer Wells was so impressive that Homer immediately showed it to Mrs. Worthington.
What you have described to me, Homer, sounds like some kind of evolving organic brain syndrome, Dr. Larch wrote. In a man of this age, there aren't a lot of diagnoses to choose from. I'd say your best bet is Alzheimer's presenile dementia. It's pretty rare. I looked it up in one of my bound volumes of the New England Journal of Medicine.
Picking imaginary lint off one's clothes is what neurologists call carphalogia. In the progress of deterioration common to Alzheimer's disease, a patient will frequently echo back what is said to him. This is called echolalia. The inability to name even familiar objects, such as a cigarette, is due to a failure to recognize the objects. This is called anomia. And the loss of ability to do any type of skilled or learned movement, such as opening the glove compartment, is also typical. It is called apraxia. You should prevail upon Mrs. Worthington to have her husband examined by a neurologist. I know there is at least one in Maine. It's only my guess that it's Alzheimer's disease.
Alzheimer's disease? Asked Olive Worthington.
You mean it's a disease what's wrong with him? Wally asked Homer.
Wally cried in the car on the way to the neurologist.
I'm sorry, Pop, he said,
but Senior seemed delighted. When the neurologist confirmed Dr. Larch's diagnosis, Senior Worthington was exuberant.
I have a disease, he yelled proudly,
even happily. It was almost as if someone had announced that he was cured. What he had was quite incurable.
I have a disease!
He was euphoric about it. What a relief it must have been to him, for a moment anyway, to learn that he wasn't simply a drunk. It was such an enormous relief to Olive that she wept on Wally's shoulder. She hugged and kissed Homer with an energy Homer had not known since he left the arms of Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna. Mrs. Worthington thanked Homer over and over again. It meant a great deal to Olive, although she had long ago fallen out of love with Senior, if she had ever truly loved him, to know that this new information permitted her to renew her respect for Senior. She was overwhelmingly grateful to Homer and to Dr. Larch for restoring Senior's self-esteem, and for restoring some of her esteem for Senior, too. All this contributed to the special atmosphere that surrounded Senior's death at the end of the summer, shortly before the harvest. A sense of relief was far more prevalent than was a sense of grief. That Senior Worthington was on his way to death had been certain for some time. That in the nick of time he had managed to die with some honor, "of a bona fide disease," Bert Sanborn said, was a welcome surprise. Of course, the residents of Hart's Rock and Hart's Haven had some difficulty with the term. Alzheimer was not a familiar name to the coast of Maine in 1940-something. The workers at Ocean View had particular trouble with it. Ray Kendall one day made it easier for everyone to understand. "Senior got Alzheimer disease," he announced. "Alzheimer. Now there was a disease anyone could understand."
"I just hope it ain't catchin'," said Big Dot Taft.
"Maybe you got to be rich to get it," wondered Meanie Hyde.
"No, it's neurological," Homer Wells insisted, but that didn't mean anything to anyone except Homer. And so the men and women at Ocean View developed a new saying as they got ready for the harvest that year.
"You better watch out," Herb Fowler would say, "or you'll get Alzheimer's."
And when Louise Toby would show up late, Florence Hyde, or Irene Titcomb, or Big Dot Taft, would ask her,
"What's the matter? You got your period or Alzheimer?"
When Grace Lynch would show up with a limp or with a noticeable bruise, everyone would think, but never say out loud,
"She got old Alzheimer last night for sure."
"It seems to me," Wally said to Homer Wells, "that you ought to be a doctor. You obviously have an instinct for it."
"Dr. Larch is the doctor," said Homer Wells. "I'm the Bedouin."
Just before the harvest, when Olive Worthington had put fresh flowers in the bedroom wing of the cider house and had typed a clean page of rules, almost exactly the same rules from the previous years, and had tacked them next to the light switch by the kitchen door, she offered the Bedouin a home.
"I always hate it when Wally goes back to college," Olive told Homer. "And this year, with Senior gone, I'm going to hate it more. I would like it very much if you thought you could be happy here, Homer. You could stay in Wally's room. I like having someone in the house at night and someone to talk to in the morning."
Olive was keeping her back to Homer while she looked out the bay window in the Worthington's kitchen. The rubber raft that Senior used to ride was bobbing in the water within her view, but Homer couldn't be sure if Olive was looking at the raft.
"I'm not sure how Dr. Larch would feel about it," Homer said.
"Dr. Larch would like you to go to college one day," Olive said. "And so would I. I would be happy to inquire, at the high school in Cape Kenneth, if they'd work with you, if they'd try to evaluate what you know and what you need to learn. You've had a very odd education. I know that Dr. Larch is interested in having you take all the sciences." Homer understood that her mind must have been recalling this from a letter from Dr. Larch.
"And Latin," said Olive Worthington.
"Latin," said Homer Wells. This was surely Dr. Larch's work. Cutaneous maximus, thought Homer Wells. Dura mater, not to mention good old umbilicus.
"Dr. Larch wants me to be a doctor," Homer said to Mrs. Worthington, "but I don't want to be."
"I think he wants you to have the option of becoming a doctor, should you change your mind," Olive said. "I think he said Latin or Greek."
They must have had quite some correspondence, thought Homer Wells, but all he said was, "I really like working on the farm."
"Well, I certainly want to keep you working here," Olive told him. "I need your help, through the harvest especially. I don't imagine you'd be a full-time student. I have to talk to the high school, but I'm sure they'd view you as something of an experiment."
"An experiment," said Homer Wells. Wasn't everything an experiment for a Bedouin? He thought about the broken knife he'd found on the cider house roof. Was it there because he was supposed to find it? And the broken glass, a piece of which had signaled to him in his insomnia at Wally's window? Was the glass on the roof in order to provide him with some message? He wrote to Dr. Larch, requesting Larch's permission to stay at Ocean View. "I'll take biology," Homer Wells wrote, "and anything scientific, but do I have to take Latin? Nobody even speaks it anymore." Where did he get to be such a know-it-all, wondered Wilbur Larch, who nevertheless saw certain advantages to Homer Wells not knowing Latin or Greek, both the root of so many medical terms. Like coarctation of the aorta, Dr. Larch was thinking. It can be a relatively mild form of a congenital heart disorder that could decrease as the patient grew older. By the time the patient was Homer's age, the patient might have no murmur at all, and only a trained eye could detect in an X-ray the slight enlargement of the aorta. In a mild case, the only symptoms might be a hypertension in the upper extremities. So don't learn Latin if you don't want to, thought Wilbur Larch. As for the best congenital heart defect for Homer Wells, Dr. Larch was leaning toward pulmonary valve stenosis. From infancy and throughout his early childhood, Homer Wells had a loud heart murmur, Dr. Larch wrote. For the record, just to hear how it sounded. At 21, he noted elsewhere, Homer's old heart murmur is difficult to detect. However, I find that the stenosis of the pulmonary valve is still apparent in an X-ray. It might be barely detectable, he knew. Homer's heart defect was not for everyone to see. That was the point. What was necessary was that it just be there. Don't take Latin or Greek if you don't want to, Dr. Larch wrote to Homer Wells. It's a free country, isn't it? Homer Wells was beginning to wonder. In the same envelope with Dr. Larch's letter was a letter Dr. Larch had forwarded to him from good old Snowy Meadows. In Wilbur Larch's opinion, Snowy was a fool, but a persistent one. "Hi, Homer. It's me, Snowy," Snowy Meadows began. He explained that his name was now Robert Marsh. "Of the Bangor Marshes, we're the big furniture family," Snowy wrote. The furniture family, thought Homer Wells. Snowy went on and on about how he'd met and married the girl of his dreams, and how he'd chosen the furniture business over going to college, and how happy he was that he'd gotten out of St. Cloud's. Snowy added that he hoped Homer had gotten out, too. "And what do you hear from Fuzzy Stone?" Snowy Meadows wanted to know. "Old Larch says Fuzzy is doing well. I'd like to write Fuzzy if you know his address." Fuzzy Stone's address, thought Homer Wells. And what did Old Larch mean? That Fuzzy is doing well. Doing well at what? Wondered Homer Wells. But he wrote to Snowy Meadows that Fuzzy was indeed doing well, that he had misplaced Fuzzy's address for the moment, and that he found apple farming to be healthy and satisfying work. Homer added that he had no immediate plans to visit Bangor. He would surely look up the furniture Marshes if he was ever in town. And no, he concluded, he didn't agree with Snowy that a kind of reunion in St. Cloud's was such a hot idea. He said he was sure that Dr. Larch would never approve of such a plan. He confessed that he did miss Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna, and of course Dr. Larch himself, but wasn't the place better left behind? "Isn't that what it's for?" Homer Wells asked Snowy Meadows. "Isn't an orphanage supposed to be left behind?" Then Homer wrote to Dr. Larch. "What's this about Fuzzy Stone doing well? Doing well at what? I know that Snowy Meadows is an idiot, but if you're going to tell him some stuff about Fuzzy Stone, don't you think you better tell me, too?" In time, thought Wilbur Larch wearily. He was feeling harassed. Dr. Gingrich and Mrs. Goodhall had prevailed upon the Board of Trustees. The Board had requested that Larch comply with Dr. Gingrich's recommendation of a follow-up report on the status of each orphan's success or failure in each foster home. If this added paperwork was too tedious for Dr. Larch, the board recommended that Larch take Mrs. Goodhall's suggestion and accept an administrative assistant. "Don't I have enough history to attend to as is?" Larch wondered. He rested in the dispensary. He sniffed a little ether and composed himself. "Gingrich and Goodhall," he said to himself. "Ginghall and Goodrich," he muttered. "Rich Hall and Gingood. Good Ging and Hallrich." He woke himself, giggling. "What are you so merry about?" Nurse Angela said sharply to him from the hall outside the dispensary.
"Good balls and ding-dong," Wilbur Larch said to her.
He went to Nurse Angela's office with a vengeance. He had plans for Fuzzy Stone. He called Bowdoin College, where Fuzzy Stone would successfully complete his undergraduate studies, and Harvard Medical School, where Larch intended Fuzzy to do very, very well. He told the registrar's office at Bowdoin that a sum of money had been donated to the orphanage at St. Cloud's for the express purpose of paying the medical school expenses of an exceptional young man or woman who would be willing, more than willing, even dedicated, to serve St. Cloud's. Could Dr. Larch have access to the transcripts of Bowdoin's recent graduates who had gone on to medical school? He told a slightly different story to Harvard Medical School. He wanted access to transcripts, of course, but in this case the sum of money had been donated to establish a training fellowship in obstetrics. It was the first traveling Wilbur Larch had done since he'd chased after Clara, the first time he'd slept in a place other than the dispensary since World War I. But he needed to familiarize himself with the transcript forms at Bowdoin and at Harvard Medical School. Only in this way could he create a transcript for F. Stone. He begged the use of a typewriter and some paper. "One of your blank transcript forms will make it easier for me," and pretended to type out the names and credentials of a few interesting candidates. "I see so many who'd be perfect," he told them at Bowdoin and Harvard, "but it's impossible to know if any of them could tolerate St. Cloud's. We're very isolated," he confessed, thanking them for their help, handing them back their transcripts, Fuzzy's in the proper place among the S's. When he had returned to St. Cloud's, Dr. Larch wrote to Bowdoin and Harvard requesting copies of the transcripts of a few outstanding graduates. He had narrowed the choices down to these few, he told them. A copy of Fuzzy's transcript came in the mail with the others. When Larch had visited Harvard Medical School, he'd taken a Cambridge post office box in Fuzzy's name. Now he wrote to the postmaster there requesting the mail for F. Stone to be forwarded to St. Cloud's. The P.O. box address would be useful, too, if young Dr. Stone were to pursue his zealous instincts to a mission abroad. Then he sent an empty envelope to the Cambridge address and waited for its return. When the letter came back to him, when he was sure the system worked, he composed the rest of the history regarding F. Stone and his adoptive family, named Eames, and sent it along to the Board of Trustees, together with Fuzzy's address. He did not have to invent anything regarding Curly Day. He cringed to write the name Roy Rinfret, and he told the truth regarding Snowy Meadows and most of the others, although he had difficulty typing the Furniture Marshes without laughing out loud. And when he came to the case of Homer Wells, he thought very carefully about how to word the matter of Homer's heart. Among the members of the board, there wasn't a heart specialist or a radiologist or even a surgeon. There was a very old GP who Dr. Larch felt sure never read anything at all. Larch didn't count Dr. Gingrich as a doctor. He counted psychiatrists as nothing at all, and he felt confident that he could bully Mrs. Goodhall with the slightest terminology. He confessed to the board—isn't everyone flattered by a confidence—that he had refrained from mentioning the matter of Homer's heart to Homer. He admitted to stalling, but argued that worrying the boy might contribute to his problem, and he wanted the boy to gain confidence in the outside world before burdening him with this dangerous knowledge. Yet he intended to burden Homer with it shortly. Larch said he had informed the Worthingtons of the heart defect. They might therefore be more than usually protective of Homer. He had not bothered to explain the presence of the actual murmur to them, or to detail the exact characteristics of pulmonary valve stenosis. He would be happy to provide the board with such details, should they request them. He had fun imagining Mrs. Goodhall scrutinizing an X-ray. He concluded that he thought the board's request for the follow-up reports had been a good idea, and that he had enjoyed himself immensely in preparing them. Contrary to needing an administrative assistant to perform such a service, Dr. Larch said he had felt positively energized by the welcome task, since, he added, following up on his orphans' adoptive lives was always on his mind. "And sometimes right off the top of my head," he thought. He was exhausted and forgot to circumcise a newborn baby boy whom Nurse Angela had prepared for the operation. He mistook a woman awaiting an abortion for a woman he'd delivered the previous day, and therefore told her that her baby was very healthy and doing fine. He spilled a small amount of ether on his face and needed to irrigate his eye. He became cross because he had overordered prophylactics. He had far too many rubbers around. Since Melanie had left, No one was stealing the rubbers anymore. When he thought of Melanie, he became worried, which also made him cross. He returned to Nurse Angela's office and wrote a report, which was real, concerning David Copperfield's lisp. He neglected to mention that David Copperfield had been delivered and named by Homer Wells. He wrote a slightly fictitious report on the orphan called Steerforth, remarking that his delivery was so straightforward that Nurse Edna and Nurse Angela had been able to handle it entirely without a doctor's assistance. He wrote the truth about Smoky Fields. The boy hoarded food, a trait that was more common in the girls' division than in the boys', and Smoky was beginning to exhibit a pattern of insomnia that Larch had not witnessed at St. Cloud's since the days of Homer Wells. The memory of those days brought instant tears to his eyes, but he recovered himself sufficiently to write that both he and Mrs. Grogan were worried about Mary Agnes Cork. She had exhibited frequent depression since Melanie's departure. He also told the truth about Melanie, although he chose not to include any acts of vandalism. Larch wrote of Mary Agnes, "Perhaps she sees herself as inheriting Melanie's former position, but she hasn't the dominating character that usually attends any powerful or leadership role." "That idiot Dr. Gingrich is going to like that," Larch imagined. "Role," Larch said aloud, scornfully, as if orphans had the luxury of imagining that they have roles. Impulsively, he went to the dispensary and inflated 2 prophylactics. Got to use these things up in some way, he thought. He used a laundry marking pen to write the name Gingrich on one prophylactic and the name Goodhall on the other. Then he took these jolly balloons and went in search of Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna. They were in the girls' division, having tea with Mrs. Grogan, when Dr. Larch found them. "Aha!" Larch said, surprising the ladies, who were unused to see him making an appearance in the girls' division, except for the evening dose of Jane Eyre, and even more unused to see him waving marked prophylactics in their faces. "Dr. Gingrich and Mrs. Goodhall, I presume," Larch said, bowing to everyone, whereupon he took a scalpel and popped the prophylactics. On the floor above them, Mary Agnes Cork heard the noise and sat up in her bed where she'd been lying in a sullen depression. Mrs. Grogan was too stunned to speak. When Dr. Larch left the ladies with their tea and returned to the hospital, Nurse Edna was the first to say something. "Wilbur works so hard," she said cautiously. "Isn't it a wonder that he can find time to be playful?" Mrs. Grogan was still struck speechless, but Nurse Angela said, "I think the old man is losing his marbles." Nurse Edna appeared to be personally wounded by this remark. She returned her teacup to her saucer very steadily before she spoke. "I think it's the ether," she said quietly. "Yes and no," said Nurse Angela. "Do you think it's Homer Wells, too?" Mrs. Grogan asked. "Yes," Nurse Angela said. "It's ether, and it's Homer Wells, and it's old age, and it's those new members on the board. It's just everything. It's St. Cloud's." "It's what happened to Melanie, too," Mrs. Grogan said, but she burst into tears when she said Melanie's name. Upstairs, Mary Agnes Cork heard Melanie's name and cried. "Homer Wells will be back. I just know it," Nurse Angela said. But this so dissolved her in tears that Nurse Edna was obliged to comfort both her and Mrs. Grogan. "There, there," Nurse Edna said to them. But she wondered, where is the young man or the young woman who's going to take care of us all? "Oh, Lord," began Mrs. Grogan. Upstairs, Mary Agnes Cork bowed her head and clasped her hands. By pressing the heels of her hands together at a certain angle, she could revive a little of the pain from her old collarbone injury. "Oh, Lord," Mrs. Grogan prayed, "support us all day long, until the shadows lengthen and the evening comes, and the busy world is hushed, and the fever of life is over, and our work is done." That night, in the darkness, in keeping with the moan of an owl, Nurse Edna whispered amen to herself, while she listened to Dr. Larch making his rounds, kissing each of the boys, even Smoky Fields, who hoarded his food and hid it in his bed, which smelled, and who only pretended to be asleep. On the Ferris wheel, high above the carnival grounds and the beach at Cape Kenneth, Homer Wells was trying to spot the roof of the cider house, but it was dark and there were no lights on.